You're listening to Campfire Conversations, brought to you by Three Rivers Land Trust. Connected to the land, committed to conservation. All right, folks, we are back for another podcast episode. I'm very excited today. We have a special guest, Mr. Dan Stern from the Botanical Garden. And he and I was talking before we actually started recording. And, you know, I think his organization, the North Carolina Botanical Garden, is one of those that holds many hats and does a lot for conservation, but not a lot of folks know about it. So we are excited to have you here today, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Katie. Just excited to be able to talk with you all about, you know, what we're all working on for conservation and, you know, get some more people sort of familiar with the North Carolina Botanical Garden and, you know, what we're working on.
That sounds great. And so before we dive into what you do with the Botanical Garden and all the arms and legs that your organization has, I'd love to hear a little bit more about you and how you even got into conservation or plant ecology, horticulture, whatever it may be, just because everybody has such a different story and kind of what tripped your trigger growing up that made you want to get in this field.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your asking. You know, I grew up down east in a tiny little town near the Pamlico Sound, and I spent a bunch of time working in the woods with my dad when I was growing up, blazing trails, and I think he was really interested in learning about the forests of coastal North Carolina, and some of that must have rubbed off on me. So, you know, when I, you know, sort of got out and started in the workforce, I did a bunch of job hopping, sort of spent some time working in a commercial fruit orchard and realized that I really like working outside. I really like working with trees. You know, I worked in commercial and residential landscaping companies in Chapel Hill for a few years and a mom and a pop greenhouse operation. And I got to a place where I felt like I knew most of the sort of mainstream garden plants that people were using. But if you took me out in the woods here in the Piedmont, I was totally lost. And I remembered that the North Carolina Botanical Garden like focuses on native plants and that they, you know, offered some internships. So I threw my hat in the ring and just feel very fortunate that I was able to do an internship here. That's got to be 25 years ago and learn from some really great mentors, each of them kind of experts in their own field. But it really lit a fire under me to, you know, continue to learn more and stay involved with the Botanical Garden here. I've been in this role with the director of horticulture for about a little over 5 years and just feel very, you know, lucky to be able to lead a really passionate team that is doing some really great stuff for a phenomenal organization.
Yeah. So was your love for plants automatic as a kid? Because, you know, I think about me growing up and, you know, before I even started studying any kind of ecology or wildlife management or botany or anything like that, you know, I always had a love for plants, but it was something that started really slow for me. So, for example, I didn't really have one of those mentors that took me around and showed me a lot of those things. But as I was outside, I would find plants. And, you know, I think folks that are interested in botany, at least for myself, I really like plant identification and knowing what's there, not only for the wildlife value, but also because unlike so many other species, once you start identifying those plants aren't going to move. It's not like a bird that you have to watch and have to worry about, you
right.
know, getting a glimpse right. of it and it flying away. But in terms of in your passion for botany, horticulture, all of that, was it something that you really had growing up or is it something that compounded as you got older? Because I know for me, it was kind of like a snowball. Once I learned 5 plants and then it was 10 plants and then it was 100 and 200. And, you know, like I really started building that foundation. Did you have that same experience or what was your story?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think my grandfather, you know, sometimes they say like the gardening thing, like skips a generation. Like
okay.
My grandfather, he was like, you know, the proverbial hunter gatherer. And he like when I was growing up, he always had like a vegetable garden and a flower garden. And I spent some time working with him in those spaces and then, you know, kind of got into, you know, and as a early teens, like helping my dad out in the woods in eastern North Carolina. And then, you know, I think all throughout my childhood, it was like that's where I loved to like spend time running around in the woods, you know, my parents' neighborhood, just kind of like enjoying being in nature. And then once I started learning it and sort of like understanding, being able to recognize plants and name plants, it just like snowballed. And now, you know, we're driving, you know, down east to visit the family, and you know, I'm calling out the vegetation on the side of the road. Yep. At 60 miles an hour, and my family is like, they've had it up to here. But yeah, it becomes infectious, right? Because these, once you get to learn them, they're like, you know, they're like friends that you see, you know, wherever you're traveling throughout the state or throughout the region. So it really is, you know, it's really been, I don't know, a gift, you know, to sort of like get to know the special plants in North Carolina, because we live in a really, you know, we live in a really special place.
Yeah. And me and my friends would also joke about that too. It's like, well, if you can identify plants going 60 miles an hour down the road, then you can identify them when you're sitting still, you know? So right. it was always one of those. It's especially when things are flowering on the roadside, it's like, oh, what's that? You know, and you automatically learn those. And like you're saying, it compounds over time. And I don't know, for me, driving down the road, just like you're saying, it's fun. It's a game. Like, you know, when you're a kid and if you have siblings in the back, you're playing, I don't know what those games are, like I Spy or whatever. And it's kind of the same thing for you as an adult, is when you're going down the road and you see you see those things flowering in a certain color, you can automatically associate those with the actual plant that they are. And that's really where my love for it stems is, you know, as a wildlife manager, you can't manage wildlife populations unless you know what the plants are, because every plant has an associated suite of species with it, whether it's good or bad, et cetera. So you have to, before you can know if that plant is good or bad for the species you're managing for, you have to know what that plant is. So that's something I find more and more every day, is how beneficial it is to actually know the plants that you're looking at. But
I think that's so important. It's such a huge part of what we do here at the Botanical Garden, is like, you know, provide the space for people to kind of like get immersed in the flora of the southeastern U.S. and the flora of North Carolina, and like give them some opportunity to start to like learn some names and recognize some things, because we really believe like once you know it in that kind of like personal way, and it becomes like a friend to you, then you're going to protect it out in the wild. You know, I remember coming here for a class. This is shortly after I started working here. I was taking a biology class or botany class here at UNC Chapel Hill, and we had a field trip, you know, to my place of work, to the North Carolina Botanical Garden. And actually, my predecessor came to meet our class and greet us, and he was like, so you all are here for a botany class, like, you know, why is this important? Why is, you know, it's important because if we don't preserve like this amazing diversity of, you know, of the flora of North Carolina, like it's all, you know, we're going to start living in a concrete jungle, you know, where everything looks the same five plants everywhere. Like, but if you want to protect this diversity, you have to start to, you know, be able to see it.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge misconception that a lot of folks have. And, you know, I'm sure I was guilty of it too, back before, I guess, I developed my ecological IQ or whatever it may be. But historically, there's a large difference in recognizing what's green and actually recognizing those plants, you know. So I think a lot of people have that. They say, oh, you know, this is a beautiful forest, this is a beautiful field, a beautiful whatever, because it's nice and green. But all of these plants have different values, so you have to recognize what those plants are to make sure they are the good plants, because plants aren't created equal. And there are so many plants that have those specific host species or whatever it may be. Therefore, you have to actually recognize what they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we had talked a little bit beforehand, something that I think is super cool, and I'll let you expand on it and maybe tell the story about the history behind it. But the Botanical Garden is pretty unique in that they have a setup there where folks can come to enjoy and look at different ecoregions across the state. So essentially, you can come and you can see plants that grow from western North Carolina all the way down to the coastal plain laid out in those different regions. Is that a fair assessment, or you have a better way to sum it up that gives it more justice.
No, that's spot on, Katie. You know, the habitat collections are what we call them. Like, they're a huge piece of what we are. We do have ornamental displays, and we do have, you know, like teaching gardens and thematic gardens. But we have, you know, one part of what we do are these habitat gardens. I think that's really unique to us. And so you can, you know, sort of walk through the middle part of the garden and essentially, you know, feel like you're traveling from the mountains of North Carolina all the way down to the coast. We've got a mountain habitat collection, Piedmont, which is our own little, you know, section of the state, the sand hills and the coastal plain. And they each have like a pretty unique sort of origin story, which I like to share with people when they come, you know, visit, or, you know, in this case, like tell people a little bit about like how these gardens were built. Probably our Sandhills Garden was one of the earliest that was built here, and this goes back to probably the early 70s. And we were connected with a quarry down near Pinehurst, and they were sort of scraping off the top layer, of an area that they were working, and literally came up here with like a convoy of 16 tandem axle trailers full of, you know, Pinehurst, Sandhills, coastal plain, or Sandhills sand, and dumped it in giant piles. And we started shifting it around and like making these contoured beds and some topography to kind of mimic on a small scale, you know, what the land looks like down there. And then started planting in that matrix, you know, planting some of the iconic plants of the sand hills. We've got some beautiful gentian that are down there, Chrysopsis or Maryland golden aster. The longleaf pine, of course, is like, you know, sort of the icon of the sand hills. So getting those plants established, and now they're full grown trees right outside my window here. You know, we've got some longleaf pines that are probably 40, 50 feet tall that, you know, were planted in the early days of the botanical garden. And we have a space where we can sort of tell people that these plants kind of co-evolved with fire before we started putting out fires with Smokey the Bear. You know, lightning ignited fires would like run across, you know, the sand hills and the Piedmont and the coastal plain, and like, you know, really clear off vegetation and exposed mineral soils, and, you know, how the plants there have kind of adapted to survive it. Some of them, like the longleaf pine, they actually need it in order to, you know, to propagate. Those longleaf pine cones, you know, hold those seeds tight until they get exposed to really hot temperatures, and then they basically pop and, you know, spread those seeds out on the soil. So it's a really cool story. Like, really, you know, what's really unique about this part of North Carolina is, you know, sort of this relationship between, you know, the natural disturbance here, fire, and like the plants that have kind of grown up with it and adapted to it.
Yeah, I think that's super cool. Like you said, the tandem axle loads of sand that you guys were having brought in, and, you know, you're not just doing that for aesthetic purposes, but because these plants that you're growing have certain needs. You know, for example, the plants that's going to grow on the top of, you know, Balsam Mountain in the western part of the state, you know, you have to have the right soils to grow and propagate those plants. So, for example, all these coastal plain sand hills plants that you're saying, they probably wouldn't grow very well in the heavy clay soils of the Piedmont. So I can't imagine of all the, you know, the hours that was put in, you know, thinking ahead of time to be able to ensure that the plants that you guys are wanting to showcase, that you have the appropriate niche location for those plants to actually grow.
Yeah, well, it is. It's an ongoing work too. You know, so we take the coastal plain habitat, for example, which, you know, we dug up near Wilmington. There was a big strip mall development going in down there, and the botanical garden, you know, cut out these 12-inch by 12-inch squares about a foot deep, put them on the back of a flatbed truck, and brought them up to Chapel Hill and put them together like a jigsaw puzzle. So we get the whole soil profile. You're getting the, you know, the perennials and the seed bank, and then you've got this real coastal plain sand, you know, 12 to maybe 18 inches deep that, you know, it's kind of superimposed on top of the Piedmont, right? So we've got red clay underneath it. And that's part of the ongoing, you know, sort of maintenance challenge in those spaces, is that the Piedmont is always trying to come back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we're weeding, a lot of the weeding that we do in the habitats is about like trying to get the Piedmont out of the coastal plain habitat and get the Piedmont out of the sandhills habitat because they're not supposed to be down there. Or sometimes it's not a black and white, it's not, but it's there or it's not there. It's about sort of proportionality. And that's a big part of like the ongoing maintenance of these habitats is like in any ecosystem, you know, you're going to have some things trying to outcompete others and trying to sort of keep things in balance so that we optimize diversity in that habitat, that diversity that's kind of representative of what that habitat is like in the wild. And we get in the coast, we talked about the sandhills and the coastal plain. You know, our mountain habitat was built, you know, through a series of like smaller scale plant rescues where botanical garden staff would catch wind of development projects happening up in western North Carolina and go up and dig up whole plants and bring them back. But that garden was very intentionally kind of developed with more sort of topography to it. Like the beds are raised higher and there's more relief between the top of the bed and the path. So you get kind of like this bald and cove, you know, or crest and cove, you know, sort of topography, again, like at a miniature scale compared to, you know, western North Carolina. But some of these plants, they need that kind of drainage or they're not going to survive. And that's another, that's an area that is really the only area where we routinely do overhead irrigation, you know, to kind of like replicate the, you know, the rain showers that hit the western part of the state very frequently during the summer. Without that, you know, those plants wouldn't survive here in the Piedmont. So you can come visit that part of the garden in the summer and, you know, it feels 10 or 15 degrees cooler than the rest of the garden. We don't have a mist running there constantly, but, you know, like once every day or two, we do like an overhead shower on it to kind of replicate those growing conditions.
I think that's interesting. And it really goes to show you, I know you and I talked before about this, about conservation comes in so many shapes and forms. You know, it's not just Trout Unlimited or Ducks Unlimited or all these other organizations or researchers or anything like that. There's so many organizations going into conservation as a whole. And, you know, that's one thing I wasn't even aware of, but it's super cool and super neat to think about that, you know, like folks from your staff, before an area was going to be developed, they're going in there and saving these plants before, you know, and repurposing them for a new use before they are totally lost. And it just really goes to show how there, it takes so many people working together to really further the conservation mission in the future.
Yeah, it's such a broad goal that, you know, we see, kind of see conservation written into, you know, everything that we do here at the Botanical Garden across all departments. You know, I run the horticulture department, but we've got a conservation department. We've got a herbarium department, our education department. You know, conservation cuts across all of it. It's kind of like the thing that unites us, but everybody has like a unique role or a unique opportunity to support it in some special way.
Yeah, and you guys also have a program, I guess, I don't know if a program's the right term for it, but conservation through propagation. You want to explain that and give like listeners an overview of what it is and why it's important?
Yeah, well, that's probably a phrase that we started banding about like in the 80s. And, you know, and back in the 80s, we were like one of the first like native plant gardens, you know, in the country, really focusing, you know, on what's special about the southeastern U.S. and why it's important to protect it. So we were like popularizing, like we wanted to show off how beautiful the diversity of North Carolina and the southeast is and like encourage people to grow these plants at home. Don't grow, you know, non-natives that aren't, you know, necessarily beneficial to the ecosystem. Like grow our plants because we live in a really cool, beautiful place. But if you're not careful about that message, people are going to go out in the woods and they're going to dig up ferns and they're going to bring them home and plant them in the yard. And that's the last thing that we want is for like people to go out and, you know, kind of rob Peter to pay Paul or, you know, pillage a natural area to make their backyard beautiful. So we recognized pretty early on that like we needed to, you know, we needed to sort of provide a pipeline for native plants at kind of like a retail scale so that people who got our message and wanted to garden with native plants, like they either could buy plants from us or they could learn how to grow them, you know, themselves from us. And so we literally, we kind of wrote a cookbook. This goes back to, you know, one of our early curators, Harry Phillips, you know, wrote a book, I think in the 1990, 1991 called Growing and Propagating Wildflowers. And it's the whole, you know, it's kind of a A to Z, you know, sort of cookbook on how you collect native seeds and dry them and clean them and store them and what sort of the germination protocols are for them. And then how you can use them in cool combinations to make an attractive landscape at home. So just, you know, really, we want people to be gardening with these plants, but we don't want it to be at the expense of our natural area. So how do we sort of like figure that out? But, you know, the botanical garden has done a lot of trailblazing in figuring out some of the propagation tricks to, you know, multiplying native plant species. And this is something that, you know, we've been working on for decades because, you know, a lot of our mainstream horticulture plants, they're brought over from different parts of Asia or the Mediterranean or Europe. And people have been doing that for hundreds of years, and those propagation techniques are well known. But, you know, it's like the mystery in your backyard, you know, the plant in your backyard, like people are just now starting to sort of figure out the various, you know, tips and tricks to collecting seed and getting good germination on it.
Yeah, and there's so many, you said so many things, it makes me want to go so many directions, but I think this is an appropriate insert for a story. Back when I was getting my undergrad, my husband and I, we went to a location, it was kind of like a little tour thing, and they had a gift shop set up, and they had a pretty little poster there that said, "Do you want a shade tree, but don't want to wait 30 years?" That was their slogan. And I got to looking, and what they were actually selling is they were selling Princess Tree seeds.
Ah, I knew you were going to say that.
And it's just like, I hate it because, I mean, you think about folks, your everyday folks that do not know plant species or do not know the implications of what they're planting. And, you know, there's such a big push. It's like, oh, yeah, we should be planting trees, or, oh, yeah, trees are good. But there's, you know, there's still a gradient there of good trees and bad trees. So I think about all the people that, one, are leaving that gift shop to plant a princess tree, or all the people that go to all your big box stores and are buying all these non-native invasive plants, and they're so well intentioned, you know, they might be buying it for their mother for Mother's Day or whatever it may be, but they just don't realize what they're actually planting. So I guess that's just a sidebar to say I hate when that happens, and I wish that there was already a larger avenue for folks. One, I guess, an avenue for the non-natives and the bad plants to be banned where they're not being sold, but an even bigger avenue for folks to have all these good native plants that are, you know, sustainably grown to be able to sell those and use those instead of the bad plants.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of anecdotal in a sense, but, you know, I started working here at the Botanical Garden 25 years ago, and, you know, it feels like we were a lonely voice, you know, in the wilderness saying native plants are cool, you know, grow native plants and get away from these invasives. And now, you know, it feels like 25 years later, like we can't keep up with the demand, you know, both for whole plants. You know, we do an annual spring plant sale and fall plant sale event here. We have plants for sale outside our gift shop 9 months out of the year. And, just the demand in the last couple of years has just exploded. And that's wonderful news. Now our challenge is like, how do we scale up our operations?
Keeping up with the demand.
Yeah, but you're right. You know, I mean, it's, I feel like we're making progress, but there's still so much, you know, so far to go to sort of like counteract that narrative or just, you know, inform people that, you know, I don't believe in bad plants, but I do believe that some plants are in the wrong place.
Yeah, and, maybe I should have said that better.
You get that princess tree, you know, and put it back where it belongs because it can cause a world of hurt, you know, here in the southeastern U.S. And that's a big part of, another big part of what the Botanical Garden is doing is, you know, one of our previous directors kind of threw down the gauntlet. This is probably in the early 90s, you know, about what position our garden was taking about non-natives and non-native and specifically non-native invasives. And we kind of like, we wrote this code of conduct, like the Reverend Martin Luther, like these are the, these are the tenets by which the North Carolina Botanical Garden is going to live. And we kind of, well, I think we blazed the trail in a lot of ways there, saying like, we're going to identify and eradicate any invasive, non-native invasive plants that are in our collections. And we're, you know, not going to, we're going to start scrutinizing any non-native that we bring into the garden, essentially evaluate whether or not it could potentially pose a problem, and take a much more kind of conservative approach to what we're going to bring in, because we are, you know, by the very nature of being a, you know, a public space and a botanical garden, like we're influencers, to use a very contemporary word, right? And like, if we're bringing plants in that we don't really understand what their ecological impact is going to be, then we could very well be like inspiring people to kind of do something that ends up being bad for the ecosystem. So now 25 years later or whatever, we're involved with this sort of national initiative called Public Gardens as Sentinels Against Invasive Species. And so, you know, we're starting to, you know, go out and systematically document like which non-natives are we seeing exhibit problematic tendencies. You know, is it something that we would say is like locally weedy in a disturbed garden, or is it something that we're starting to see encroach in natural areas? And it's not just the North Carolina Botanical Garden acting by itself. It's us like contributing observational data along with botanical gardens all across the country, so that we get like a more comprehensive picture of what the next princess tree is going to be. You know, one of the ones that we're looking at here is a Chinese parasol tree, Fermiana simplex. It's not a very common horticulture plant. It's beautiful, but I think it's just not been widespread. But starting to see, you know, signs that it can be weedy and problematic here. And so we took ours out 4 or 5 years ago. Just trying to be a little bit more conservative, a little bit more preemptive, and not wait for something to become a big problem.
Yeah, and you know, when you really sit down and look at it, North Carolina just has such a diversity of plants and so many plants that are beautiful and unique all in their own, you know, like, for example, carnivorous plants. Like, how cool is that? That, and there are so many species of those carnivorous plants that are endemic to North Carolina. They might not grow anywhere else. So it's just like, we really do have this diversity of plants and so much going on here, one that warrants conservation, because, you know, if we don't save them or we don't protect them, then they may be lost forever. And then once those plants are lost, any, for example, moth or butterfly or, you know, like all these other species that could also be associated with that plant would also be lost. And then it's just that kind of cascading effect that could occur.
Right.
But, you know, again, like this happens all the time for, like I said, I consult with a lot of landowners on their own property. And as a part of that, I'll often go out and walk with landowners and I might point out a flower that they have native growing on their property naturally, and they're like, oh my goodness, I've never seen this is a beautiful plant. And you know, it's like, this looks better than the things that I am planting in my garden. Why would I not plant this? And you know, then we start really going into that conversation of how beautiful natives can be, and oftentimes can be very, very easy to grow in your garden because they are naturally adapted to these locations.
Yeah, and I think there's another aspect to that conversation, which is, you know, like maybe opening our eyes a little bit further about like what is beautiful. You know, I feel like we've got great native plants that are great for pollinators. They've got like, you know, showy flowers during a certain portion of the year. Maybe they, you know, then their flowers sort of like, you know, mature into, you know, fruit capsules or, you know, fruit structures, and like they've got a really cool architecture to them. And like, if you can, you know, when you start seeing, you know, start appreciating like that beauty, you know, of the different structures on the plant, even when it's not a big showy flower, like you know, I think it's just really eye-opening about, like, just how amazing, you know, our native flora is. And it's, you know, another part of what we're working on now is, you know, thinking not just about what we garden with, but about how we garden with it. You know, there's kind of this tendency in the garden world, but, you know, we're in December now, so everybody's, like, got their, you know, ready for, got their leaf rake, you know, maybe they're putting their leaf rake up, and they're getting out their clippers, and they're getting ready to cut everything down, and, like, you know, winter cleanup for the garden, and, like, that's habitat. That's a mm-hmm. lot of really, really important habitat. You know, you think about, like, the if you add up the backyards of America, like, we're talking about national park scale, right? And so, but if we're constantly raking out our leaves and, you know, blowing them into a chipper, or we're cutting back all of the hollow stems, you know, from perennials that are done for the year, like, the little critters have got no place to live, you know. So it's about thinking about maybe other ways of doing things. We do a lot with wattle fences in some of our garden areas where we are cutting down dormant stems of perennials, but we're, like, stacking them or creating little fence structures with them so that they stay on the property and they stay on site. And so the little solitary bees, or, you know, whoever's laid eggs in there, like, they get to stay in the garden too, and then emerge in the spring when things warm up. It's just, like, just kind of thinking about gardening in a way that is, like, more in concert with, or in cooperation with, you know, Mother Nature, rather than, like, trying to have dominion over Mother Nature.
A passion for firearms and a bit of mechanical aptitude can be the building blocks of a fantastic career path. Montgomery Community College's gunsmithing program can help make this a reality. MCC's gunsmithing program allows for independence and self-sufficiency as you create, repair, and customize firearms. This curriculum is designed to prepare students for existing jobs within the firearms industry. Instructional topics range from basic diagnostics and repair to true custom builds. Students gain valuable experience in areas as varied as machining, tooling, blueprinting, metal finishing, repair, and stockwork. Familiarity with the laws and regulations governing firearms and associated businesses is stressed. At MCC's gunsmithing program, the majority of class time is spent in a shop environment, bringing theory to a practical application in a hands-on setting. Basic machining projects consist of gunsmithing tools that can be used later when working on firearms. Other notable projects include three custom rifle builds and a custom 1911 handgun. As one of only four NRA-affiliated gunsmithing schools in the United States, MCC offers a variety of NRA short-term gunsmithing courses taught by nationally known experts. These seminar-type courses vary from only 3 days to 2 weeks in length and are available to anyone interested, not exclusively to curriculum students. These offerings are tailor-made for somebody who is interested in learning but can't devote 2 years to the full degree program. Courses include topics such as rifle accurizing, basic handgun repair, reloading, knife making, even shooting instruction. Firearms industry leaders such as Smith & Wesson, Sig Arms, Glock, Beretta USA, Sturm Ruger, and Cerakote have all brought their staff experts to MCC. Learn valuable skills and stay right here in Central North Carolina, quite possibly the most perfect place in the world to be a gunsmithing student. Situated in the midst of the Uori National Forest, students have access to some of the state's most beautiful terrain. Our campus is just a 15-minute journey to the Baden Lake and Lake Tillery recreation areas, which feature swimming, boating, boat rental, fishing, and numerous other water sports. Hunting deer, turkey, and numerous other game is a dominant hobby starting in the fall months as well. Gunsmithing is considered one of MCC's heritage crafts programs, and other specialty programs include taxidermy, hunting and shooting sports management, forest management technologies, pottery. Just visit montgomery.edu, MONTGOMERY.edu, to see course descriptions and explore the exciting world of gunsmithing for yourself.
Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break from the show to talk about one of our sponsors, Backcountry Beyond. They're located at 322 South Main Street in Salisbury, North Carolina, right in the heart of downtown. You know, with Christmas approaching, this is the best place to go and get some of your Christmas gifts. They've got everything from e-bikes to solo stoves to BioLite fire pits, Yeti coolers, cups, chairs, you name it. All kinds of apparel, Traeger grills, spices, Smithy cast iron. They have everything. I mean, you can't go in and walk out without getting something at the store. It's incredible. So if you're looking for the best Christmas gifts and you need to get it today, tomorrow, you can order it online. You can go in store. They've got it all. So be sure to go check out our friends over at Backcountry and Beyond and get your holiday shopping done today.
Yeah, I think that's also, you know, pretty neat that what you're saying is recognizing beauty in these plants, because a pretty plant or whatever it may be is not that does not necessarily coincide with a showy flower. And like when you said that, automatically in my head, I think about my house, for example. We've restored a lot of the old fields there back to native plants through various mechanisms, whatever. But like things like little blue stem and broom sedge blue stem, these grasses, you know, they don't have these beautiful showy flowers like a cardinal flower would, or, you know, milkweed, whatever. But in the wintertime, you know, like last year's growth, the dead plant material that's standing there, like blowing in the wind, like that is a beautiful picturesque picture, whatever, that you can come in, like once the sun starts setting through it, it truly is beautiful. But they don't have showy flowers, just like you're saying. So it's, I mean, yeah, it really goes to show you the diversity we have and how beautiful they all can be.
Yeah, well, we were talking about carnivorous plants a little while ago, and we've got like probably one of the best carnivorous plant displays out in the country out here, you know, outside of my office building in the heart of the botanical garden. Like we've got all of the, you know, we've got the big names of the Venus flytrap and the pitcher plants, and they're glorious. But we've also got these really cool sundews, you know, these little, like fine sort of grassy, you know, leaves that then have like, the, you know, this glistening, you know, sort of sap on them that trap little insects. And like you catch that in the late afternoon light, like you catch, you know, the split beard blue stem or something, and like it just glistens, and like that's magic.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, like these are plants that like don't have widespread, you know, distribution. They're like a really cool part of what North Carolina has to offer. You know, I think it's about sort of like finding out what's really beautiful about home, and just like we're so fortunate to live in such a diverse and beautiful state, and trying to open people's eyes to see that, and you know, and to celebrate it in their own backyard.
Yeah, and I think something else that's pretty neat, you know, we're mentioning landscaping and everything like that. So let's say, for example, there's a landowner that does not have the mechanisms or the acreage, whatever it may be, to have these large scale plantings, but they want to do something ecologically appropriate and they want to go back to native plants in their landscape beds. What would Dan Stern's top five list be for either, one, your favorite plants to see? Maybe there should be two lists. Your favorite plants, personally favorite, and then maybe top five, top couple, whatever, for a landowner that, you know, that you set them up for success, that's going to be these pretty native plants, but also those plants that aren't going to be hard to grow, to kind of set those landowners up for success.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to vary a little bit depending on what part of the state you're in, right? Because our soils are so different. But, you know, I guess I would give like broad suggestions, like pick some colorful perennials. And we've got like hundreds of species that you could pick from. But, you know, so pick some things that like, you know, maybe flower, you know, get something that flowers really early in the year, like green and gold, a little ground cover thing that's got pretty little yellow flowers. And honestly, we see that flowering at our garden here 12 months out of the year. Not all of them, but you can't come to this garden in a single month out of the year and not find one example of it flowering. And that's great for the bees, right? You've got like early and late season, you know, sources of, you know, important food for the pollinator. So, you know, green and gold, that's a great example. You mentioned cardinal flower, you know, something that's going to attract butterflies and hummingbirds midsummer. Like, we've got scads of really great perennials that do that. So, you know, get some things that are going to bring, attract some pollinators, attract some birds into your, you know, into your backyard habitat, because ultimately that's what we're talking about. Kind of taking full advantage of, like, the, you know, little square footage that we have, you know, say over, and like creating something positive there. You know, I also think it's important to think about, it's not just about providing like nectar and pollen. Like, a lot of our critters, like, they need some place to kind of like nestle in the winter. So, like, bunch grasses, like split-beard blue stem or little blue stem, that, you know, these things that, you know, they have a sort of a finer foliage, and they create some little ground habitat for little critters to live in. Evergreen shrubs, you know, I'd say we mentioned wax myrtles or red cedars. You know, these are really important plants. Some of them, you know, they provide a food stuff. If you get girls, you know, they provide sort of a waxy berry if it's a wax myrtle, or a fleshy cone if it's a eastern red cedar. But it's about the evergreen foliage, and give those birds like some place to kind of shelter when it gets, the conditions get really harsh. So, you know, it's not just about showy pollinator plants, but it's really thinking about like habitat, and how can you create you know, haven for, you know, for wildlife to come and, you know, feel safe and secure, and, you know, have their basic needs met in your backyard. And honestly, you know, I'm sure you know, Katie, like, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be grandiose. You know, you leave a you know, you leave a saucer or a bird bath on the ground with some water in it, and some frogs are going to get there quick. And, you know, the nature is out there. It's like looking for, the wildlife is out there. It's looking for sort of hospitable places to spend time.
Sure. And what about you personally? Is there, do you have a favorite plant, or one of those plants that's kind of on your life list, or something that you just get super excited to see in the woods in terms of a native plant?
It changes all the time.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. I don't know. Right now, you know, when all of the trees are, you know, have most of them anyhow have lost their leaves, like, I can't help but, you know, really appreciate the American beech tree that's in our woods, you know, still hanging on to those leaves, and it will continue to for probably the next 2 months, you know. Really has kind of a unique presence in the forest in the middle of the winter. I don't know. I'm a, you know, I guess I'm always extolling like the praises of let's see, Agarista populifolia. It's a coastal fetter bush. It's a really beautiful evergreen that has some you know, very sweet smelling flowers in, you know, mid to late spring. I love seeing that in people's landscapes. I think it's a great plant that I wish more people were using.
I remember when I was very first, like, I might have still been early high school, walking through the woods, and it was probably a time very similar to now in terms of the year, and all the trees had lost their leaves, and I was like, man, what is this tree with these beautiful gold leaves that's still holding leaves, you know? And then I, like, got out a plant ID book, and just like you're saying, the beech trees, if you, yeah, like, if you go out in the woods right now and you see a tree that's that has those persistent leaves, and like, once you actually start looking at the leaves, I think their leaves are beautiful because all the veins, you know, it looks like you almost drew them with a ruler. They're so straight. But if you go out right now and you see those trees with the persistent leaves, that is an American beech tree, and one of the most common trees that we have in our forest. But you know, like, just like you're saying, the beauty of it is it truly is beautiful.
Yeah, another one that comes to mind, you know, this season, if we were having this conversation, you know, another 3 months, there'd be a whole another handful of plants on my mind. But, you know, like the little spidery yellow flowers of witch hazel, little understory shrub that, you know, we see sort of dotted along the creeks and the streams around here. Like, you know, it started flowering, you know, 3 weeks ago or something like that. And, you know, it's flowering in late November and December, and you might even see some in January. like, who does that? Yeah. Everybody else is going to bed, right? But this thing has started to flower. And again, like, you know, there's, it's not the showiest flower, but man, are they cool looking? If you really get close and you see that kind of like crinkled sort of spiral petals, you know, against what is like, you know, a dark winter sky or something, it's like, you know, bringing some light into the space. You know, and I learned recently that when those witch hazels, they've got this really cool fruit structure, you know, that flower ripens into a little seed, and it actually, like, those seed pods explode, and those seeds spiral like a football does.
Yeah.
Like a quarterback has thrown that seed, so when it spirals and it hits the ground, that little corkscrew motion helps that seed nestle down in the dirt, you know, which is what that plant has kind of like, that's a little trick it's learned to, you know, increase its germination and likelihood to sort of like leave another generation. Like, how amazing is that?
I think that
a plant is throwing like spirals.
That is truly, I mean, it's almost like awe-inducing in terms of how intricate a lot of these things are, just like you're saying, with the seed structure or how the seeds get to the next generation. Like, even before this podcast, I was looking up bladder warts and like watching a video. Like, anybody can go on YouTube, just type in bladder warts. And bladder warts are, again, those carnivorous plants, but they're an aquatic plant, so they're different than a lot of other plants. But essentially, they have, I guess a good way to put it would be a suction trap, and they have these small little sacs that have bristles, and when something moves by, they kind of have a trap door that opens up and it sucks in, you know, whatever they're eating, I guess, for lack of better terms. But it's truly phenomenal how these plants, wow, you know, either get their energy and or, you know, all the different seed strategies. Like, for example, a lot of the desmodiums, if you go out in the woods in certain times of the year, or old fields, whatever, and you come back with all these seeds stuck to you, it's like all of these plants have a specific reason that they're doing what they're doing to help ensure that those plants get perpetuated into the next generation. Just so many different strategies.
Right, right. Yeah, it is really awe-inducing, for sure.
So something else I want to make sure we hit on, and I'm sure you have a lot of knowledge on, is the arboretum. So do you want to give us a little bit of information about the arboretum, y'all's role in it, and essentially what it is for somebody that's maybe never been, or just a good overview?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I'll get there, but I want to like
I love it.
provide a little context first.
Okay.
You know, the North Carolina Botanical Garden is like a big umbrella organization. So we steward over 1,200 acres of land. A lot of those are like nature preserve spaces in and around Chapel Hill. You know, our main sort of headquarters, the North Carolina Botanical Garden, we've got about 10 acres of horticultural spaces and an adjacent probably 80 or 90 acres of nature trails that go up on the hillside. We've got a 367 acre biological preserve about a mile away that, you know, joins up to the Jordan Lake wildlands. We've got a Penny's Bend Nature Preserve up in Durham County is another big tract of natural area that we preserve. So, you know, we're spread over a lot of different areas. Those conservation areas, those nature preserves, are managed through our conservation department. And some of them are, you know, owned by the state of North Carolina, those that happen to be like, you know, here on UNC property. But we also have a 501c3, a nonprofit that supports our organization called the North Carolina Botanical Garden Foundation. And one of their main reasons for existence is to sort of acquire and preserve natural land. And so they hold sort of the title on a number of other conservation tracts and conservation easements that we help manage, you know, to protect green spaces and wildlife corridors really throughout this, you know, this part of the state. So then, you know, within that 1,200 acres, we've got, you know, rather small percentage of it is like managed horticultural gardens. So we've got about 10 acres here at our main site, which is just below the Dean Dome. And then we manage another 5-acre garden, which is up on the main campus at UNC Chapel Hill, and that's the Coker Arboretum. And the Arboretum's turning 120 years old next year, so that's a pretty big deal. I just actually looking at a publication about the Morton Arboretum up in Chicago celebrating its 100th anniversary. That's a big name public garden, but I was like, but we got 20 years on them with the Coker Arboretum. So this is a really cool, we call it, it's like the Central Park of Chapel Hill. It is, you know, nestled in the middle of UNC's campus, and it's like two blocks from downtown Chapel Hill. So it's really, kind of a green oasis in the middle of Chapel Hill. Student body spends a lot of time there. People from the community spend a lot of time there. And it's like a, it's a very sort of laid back, sort of casual green space. That has like this 120-year-old sort of legacy of different horticultural trends, if you will. The garden was started by UNC's first professor of botany, Dr. William Chambers Coker. And before he got involved, it was like a wet pasture that faculty were literally like grazing their livestock out there. And he was, I guess it was the president of the university at that time, kind of challenged Dr. Coker to do something more with the space. And it was right outside the biology department, at least that's where the biology department lived 120 years ago. And so Dr. Coker felt like it would be really great if we could convert that space into like an outdoor classroom where they could teach botany, they could teach pharmacognosy, pharmacology, and get people recognizing sort of like the value of plants in the medicinals, capacity. So it's it's stayed sort of an intact green space, which is miraculous in and of itself when you think about like how much Chapel Hill has grown and how much UNC Chapel, the university has grown. But it's been this like little green gem in the middle of campus. And it's gone through these different, eras. There are a lot of Asian plants that are planted there, sort of reflecting like this sort of this horticultural legacy of where do we import, garden plants from? We import a lot of garden plants from East Asia because of the similarities in our climate. And those things are kind of predisposed to do well when they get over here to, the eastern U.S. Some of them, as we were talking about a minute ago, some of them do too well.
Right.
And then those become invasive and problematic. So that's definitely like one collection that we've really had to take a long, hard look at and get rid of those things that, are non-native and invasive. In fact, we're getting ready to break ground on a big renovation up there. This is a renovation of a 300-foot-long vine-covered walkway. That runs along one edge of the Arboretum. It's a beautiful structure, campus landmark next to, probably second only to the old well. Dr. Coker started that, built that structure in 1911, and he planted it with the horticultural plants of his day, which included like Akebia and Chinese wisteria and a whole bunch of other things. And pretty quickly it became like a monoculture of Chinese wisteria that was, flowering heavily and fruiting heavily. And, those seeds were washing up in, natural areas that we manage and neighborhoods that, surrounding neighborhoods. And we went through a renovation of that arbor 25 years ago where we tore the whole structure down because the wooden members were starting to fail. And we felt like, wow, we've got like kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity here to kind of undo this wrong. This is not, again, like I don't believe in a bad plant, but Chinese wisteria surely shouldn't be here. And so when we did that renovation in 1996-97, we ripped out all of these non-native invasive vines. We rebuilt a brand new, wooden structure. And then replanted it with all native vines to really showcase like how you can, use native vines in an ornamental way. And it's really been outstanding. So we're looking forward to another opportunity. 25 years later, the structure starting to degrade a little bit. So we're going to sort of like refresh it and an opportunity to sort of refresh the plantings there. So it's a very cool garden. You know, I'd encourage anybody who's visiting Chapel Hill to come visit both sites. The botanical garden just below the Dean Dome, and then the Coker Arboretum is kind of tucked away behind the Moorhead Planetarium downtown. But, you know, the 120-year-old garden that really has an amazing collection of big canopy trees, you know, things that have been, you know, growing for well over a century. And it just creates this really spectacular sort of environment up there.
Yeah, is that, I guess this is kind of a side note, but is that a hazard that you guys often see? Because I think about the lifespan of tree species in like 120 years, I'm sure a lot of those trees are aging out. So is that problematic for you guys that you routinely see of, you know, the trails that you have and all these massive trees that may start to die very soon?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, we have to, you know, routinely sort of like go through and, you know, I mean, take frequent and careful sort of observations about, you know, the health of the trees. We've got some great support from some corporate sponsors, you know, including Bartlett that comes out and does some pro bono work for the Botanical Garden. And in the last year, that included like coming and doing essentially like a resistograph. They kind of did like an x-ray on a giant oak tree in the arboretum. We were starting to see some decline in the canopy and some heartwood fungus at the trunk of the tree, but we really didn't know, you know, how serious is it, how extensive is, you know, the cavity, if there's a cavity in there. And they came and they did like a very scientific analysis of it, and they said, you know, you've got a big void in the middle of this tree, but there's lots of sound wood, you know, a foot thick on all sides. And we'll continue to keep a close eye on it and continue to, you know, sort of take measurements and evaluate it. But it is really, you know, it takes like constant vigilance to sort of make sure that, you know, we're doing everything that we can to sort of take care of the trees, you know, whether it's resist a graft sort of x-ray, or we're doing like treatment for to protect the tree against emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
You know, a non-native insect that, you know, if we don't watch it, we'd lose big specimens. The other big challenge with a garden like that is there isn't necessarily a whole lot of sunlight to get the next generation of trees going.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really have to sort of be mindful anytime we take something out, you know, where do we have opportunities to get a successor, you know, established so that 100 years from now, people still have a really cool historic garden to visit.
Yeah. So if folks are interested in coming out and checking out the garden or the arboretum, open to the public, correct?
Open to the public. The main botanical garden, we're open Tuesday through Saturday from 9 till 5, and then we're open on Sundays from 1 till 5. And the arboretum is, you know, it's a gated but open to the public from dawn till dusk.
Yes.
Year round.
So free of charge, is that correct, or is there a charge to come?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right. Free of charge. You know, incredible resources that the state of North Carolina and the university support, and, you know, just trying to make ourselves as accessible to as many people as possible and, you know, encourage people to come take full advantage of it.
Yeah, well, man, it definitely sounds like a great learning opportunity for anybody, you know, not just folks that are super interested in botany and plants and ecology, but also for folks to learn about these species, you know, and maybe get your feet wet under, you know, a nice controlled environment and learning about all the different plants that occur in our area or even in your backyard. So definitely a great opportunity for folks to get out there and learn something about the natural world that you're living in. But I think we're going on almost an hour now. So any other hot topic items that you want to share with listeners before we begin to wrap up?
You know, Katie, I appreciate that. You know, I call attention to a couple branches, since we'll use that metaphor of the tree of the North Carolina Botanical Garden. But, that may be not so obvious to people that, you know, come and visit our gardens, which again, like that's, we encourage everybody. We've got really great resources and experiences to share here. But we also, you know, have an herbarium, which is like a library sort of museum collection of dried specimens. And they are, you know, essentially like the reference material for any living collection of plants. And so that's an arm or a branch of the North Carolina Botanical Garden that is housed up on the main campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But, you know, my colleagues that work in that department, they're the ones that are, you know, doing the classification and identification of new species. Which is such a fundamental sort of building block to conservation work. Like we can't protect it until we can sort of like articulate what it is and where it grows and, you know, how it's distinct from other, you know, maybe closely related plants. So it's like really, really important science and maybe not as obvious to, you know, first-time visitors to our garden, but it's there and they do just such important, you know, foundational work, right, that all conservation is kind of like dependent on. If you want to write legislation about, you know, protecting a threatened species, you have to first be able to sort of, you know, make a coherent statement about like what that species is, right, and how you define it. And, you know, I'd also say our conservation department, I've spoken, you know, about the work that they do in land management, you know, in terms of the nature preserves that are under our umbrella. But they also do a lot of really great work in terms of rare plant, you know, reintroduction and ex situ conservation. We've got a lot of seed banking activities here where the efforts of our staff are sort of tied in with, you know, other, you know, sort of conservation organizations that are, you know, saving seed, you know, against future, you know, natural disaster or loss. And we, for the last couple of years, they are, again, this is in the conservation department, they've really had this incredible program going called the Native Plant Materials Development Program. It's a lot of big words stacked on top of one another, but it's really recognizing that people that are doing restoration work in the southeastern U.S. need more eco-specific seed sources, you know, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, to replant, you know, Andropogon ternarius or split beard bluestem, you know, that is from seed collected from the southeast is so much better than, you know, importing seed from the Midwest. It's, you know, when you can really dial it into the specific ecotype. So we've got this program going where we're basically growing out a subset of species, I think now approaching 300 different species that we're growing out that are really the basic building blocks of restoration work. And we're growing them out in like almost an agricultural sense to harvest seed at an agricultural scale so that then we can provide seed or we can provide landscape plugs to Triangle Land Conservancy or the Nature Conservancy or the Department of Transportation, people that are doing restoration work on a really large scale, and they need like, you know, specific sort of ecotype seeds or plugs to get that job done. And that's it's a new space for us to step into, but it feels like there's such a need in the Southeast for there to be like a clearinghouse that's got enough, you know, that is being strategic about how to grow stuff at a large scale to help supply restoration at a large scale, because that's so important.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just like you're saying, that's another thing that conservationists should be aware of are the ecotypes of the plants that you're getting, just because there's so much in science that we still don't know. Like, I think a great example to illustrate that is there's a place in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I completed my master's research, and it's a nature center, kind of like a botanical garden as well. And a lot of the invasive species in that area started in that location because they were bringing all these plants in because they love plants, you know, but I think that same kind of mentality is something that we mm-hmm. should be aware of, because again, we might think we're doing the right thing by getting plant species from Kansas because, you know, they're native to the U.S., but in reality, ecotypes are important because, you know, the region that they come from and they're going to continue to grow, again, have a suite of species associated with them as well. And it just kind of makes sense to get it where it actually came from or where it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, any other parting thoughts that you want to leave folks with? You know, I want to be sure to extend my thanks not only to you, but all of your staff and the folks working there for all the work that you do for conservation, just because, like we mentioned it, conservation wears many hats, and you guys definitely do your part in wearing that hat, and we're greatly appreciative of that. And again, to you for taking an hour of your time to talk to folks and hopefully increase knowledge and awareness of native plants and their importance.
Well, likewise, you know, I appreciate your time and getting to know a little bit more about the work that you all do. It's nice when we, you know, start putting faces to the names of other organizations that are like doing incredible work that's so important to preserving, you know, this special part of the planet that we all call home.
Yeah, so I encourage folks to get out there, check out their website, North Carolina Botanical Garden. They have a great website that you can peruse in your spare time and get your feet wet looking at a bunch of the different great programs they offer. They really do. I knew I was kind of blown away when I first started looking at their website of all the different things that you guys offer, and there truly is something there for probably everybody. You know, if you're interested in the outdoor world, there's something there that you're going to enjoy or get a benefit from somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. It's ncbg.unc.edu. Yeah, I appreciate that. There's a lot of great stuff, and the website's changing all the time.
Sounds good. Well, it's been a pleasure, and until next time. If you like the show and would like the episodes to keep coming, you should know that our podcast is just one of the tools that we use at Three Rivers Land Trust to further our conservation mission. Our number one priority and purpose is to conserve land and natural resources for future generations and to be a voice for wildlife and to ensure wildlife populations have habitat forever here in North Carolina. This podcast is just a byproduct to further that mission. You can visit our website at trlt.org to join us in this conservation mission.